Hi, all. Thank you for coming. we've had sort of a dramatic couple of weeks at Quarter Life, and some folks know about it, some folks don't. I think in general, not a lot of people in the culture know about Quarter Life. So, you know, I'm going to make some assumptions that if you're in this room, you know something about what we've done. But I think I'll take a few minutes just to kind of give you the short form background of sort of how this came to be, what it is, what it's trying to be, what the interesting obstacles have been, because boy, there have been a lot. It's been sort of fascinating. I'm an old media person. I come from movies and television, and you know, I would think that the main reason I started thinking about trying to do content on the internet was just I was so pissed off at the TV business and the movie business, because it's so controlled by these big corporations now that tell you what to do and take what you create and exploit it for themselves. And for somebody like me, who's always had a real problem with authority, it was just very hard to stomach having somebody else tell me what to do. We, you know, in our work in the past, Ed Zwick and I, you know, when we did 30 something, when we did My So-Called Life, we were really spoiled. We would do these shows and we would never get a note from the network. Even as ABC considered to be My So-Called Life a total failure and had no idea what they had on their hands, they never told us how to fix it. They just let it die. So in the modern world where you have, you know, basically a committee at a network that tells you how you should write the script and what the character should sound like and what they should wear and what it should look like, it just has become increasingly difficult to be there. So it was sort of revenge, I guess, in some sense, you know, that we kept joking for years that, you know, that some kid somewhere was going to make a movie for $15,000 and put it on the internet and make $80 million and make the studios irrelevant. And finally, it got to the point where we said, why can't we be the kids? You know, what is stopping us? So that moment came 2 years ago. We had actually done a pilot for ABC called Quarter Life, which people think is this pilot because it has the same name. But actually, it has no relationship whatsoever to this pilot, except that they were people in their 20s. We made that pilot. We weren't happy with it. We threw it out entirely throughout the whole story, throughout all the characters, throughout the cast, which was painful because I loved them. But we started completely from scratch. And it was in the process of coming up with this new idea, this new story, that all of a sudden it was about this girl, Dylan, who blogs about her friends. And the internet was such a big part of the story that it was one of those moments. You know, I turned to Ed and I said, this is the thing we should be doing on the internet. So even then, at that moment, we tried to do it with ABC as an internet project. And we spent about 6 months wrangling with Disney, trying to deal with their corporate strategy versus what we wanted to do. And finally, everyone realized it just wasn't going to work, that they just needed to control it in a way that we would never be happy with. So they gave it back to us, much to their credit, and it was ours. Now, during that period, I came up with the idea that we should also create a social network to go along with it, also called Quarter Life. The idea being that it was, you know, we're surrounded in our lives by people in their 20s. I have kids in their 20s, and my whole office is filled with people in their 20s. And what we were seeing more and more was this sort of unmet need for people trying to get their careers going, trying to get their lives going, to sort of figure out how you do that in some way, to get support, to get input, to have a community around that. And also some sense that there was something lacking on the internet in terms of what would allow people to deal with and talk about the things that really concern them at an intimate level, at a deep level, at an emotional level. And that what I was seeing on MySpace and what I was seeing on Facebook had nothing to do with that. I mean, they're amazing. They do really cool stuff, but they don't do that. So the idea was, could you create a social network that would facilitate a deeper connection between people than we're used to seeing on the internet? That was the theory. And that was the theory of the show, because that's what all of our shows finally are about. They're all about inner lives in some way. So we realized that there was a potential business advantage to this, which would be the fact that we would have a show. And I'm saying this with some irony now, because you'll know in a minute why it ends up being ironic. But the idea was, you make a show and the show becomes popular and the show brings people to your social network. That the show, without intending it to be, and I'm not saying this in a cynical way, I'm just saying it's a sort of a byproduct. The show becomes this incredible promotional tool for your social network. And no one had ever done that before. I mean, there's a show on TV called The L Word that created a social network, but that was after they were on the air for a few years and they already had that community. So they said, let's concretize this community. But the idea of starting something twinned in that way, a piece of entertainment and a social network and some way in which they were inevitably intertwined and reflected upon each other, had not been done. And that appealed to a lot of people from a business standpoint for the reasons I talked about. So we plunged into it. We made this pilot. I made this pilot, this hour-long pilot, with my own money. And at that time, we sort of consulted a lot of people about content on the internet. And there were a lot of people who considered themselves to be experts. And the first thing we were told was, well, you're an idiot if you think you can put an hour-long show on the internet. No one will watch an hour-long show on the internet. So we believe that. And of course, now my guess is that most of the people in this room watch whatever television shows they like to watch on their computers. But this wasn't really happening then, or wasn't widespread enough to have penetrated the consciousness of people who considered themselves to be expert a year and a half ago. So I said, all right, if I can't do an hour-long show on the internet, what if I break it up into pieces? I'll still do an hour-long show because I don't know how to tell a story that becomes emotional in less than an hour. I can't tell a two-minute story that makes you emotional. It just doesn't work like that. So I said, if I break it up into six pieces, which is something I know how to do, and each piece is 8 or 9 minutes long, what about that? And they said, you just don't get it. You can't make anything longer than 2 minutes on the internet. The drop-off after 90 seconds is two-thirds. It's just never going to work. And that was the moment where I said, okay, if I just listen to what people tell me, I'm never going to get anywhere. And I said, I believe that the smallest increment I know how to make what I'm doing is these 8 minute things. And that's what we're going to do. If it doesn't work, we'll change it. So, we made a deal with MySpace. Which was a complicated, difficult deal to negotiate because they are a social network and we were trying to create a social network. They did not want to be embarrassed. It's not like they were afraid of us. That would be stupid. But they nevertheless, as I've seen actually with this whole enterprise, the press and the blogosphere is not afraid to express opinions. And if by some mischance, a million people left MySpace and came to quarterlife.com, that would be an embarrassment for them, even though they would never notice it, in their bottom line. So it was a very complicated negotiation that ended up just being a straight distribution deal where they were going to premiere our episodes. And then 24 hours later, the episodes would appear on quarterlife.com. They would just share revenue with us 50-50. They had no control. This is very important to us. No control and no ownership and no rights past just putting it on their site. So that was a deal we were willing to make. At that point, we started attracting advertisers. And at that point, my theory was, and again, I say this with some irony because it didn't work, but my theory was that if you gave people a different kind of content on the internet that they were not yet used to seeing on the internet, but that was emotionally satisfying like they were used to seeing in movies or on television, then they might show up in different numbers and they might show up in different with a different mindset, and that might be of interest to advertisers. So all the definitions that we have now about CPMs could potentially be exploded if the audience behaved in a very different way. Now, in retrospect, you know, I think I was right, but I think that'll be 3 years from now. It wasn't ready to be right now. And we did get two advertisers to put up major, major dollars in advance, which, as you know, is very rare on the internet, Pepsi and Toyota. And we did make enough money from them to start production on new episodes. And so we were on our way. But nevertheless, the people that were advising me were saying to me all along, you know, you're doing a show on the internet that costs 3, 4, 5 times what anything has ever cost on the internet. And you're never going to really make this work without a television component. And I kept trying to push this aside, saying, I'm not making a television show. I'm here because I don't want to make a television show. I want to make an internet show. But, you know, there was this ongoing debate for months. What do we do about TV? What do we do about TV? Which was finally resolved by Ben Silverman, who had seen the pilot before he went to NBC and loved it, coming to us when he got to NBC saying, I want to put this on my network. So when NBC comes calling, you're happy. And we were thrilled about that. We had to make sure that people understood that this was not a television show in sheep's clothing, you know, that this was something that always intended to be on the internet, but here we were going to TV. And there were certain key aspects of the TV deal that were unprecedented that I'm very proud of. The main one being that not only did we still own this 100%, but we creatively controlled it 100%. That's never happened in the history of television, ever. In 60 years, we were delivering completed episodes to them. They didn't know what the stories were. They had never read the scripts. They had no input whatsoever. It was entirely our show. So that was a huge win for us. So in terms of a lot of the things that were important to me about getting this thing going, I felt, God, if I can be on TV in this kind of way without sacrificing the heart of what I'm doing and without sacrificing control, why shouldn't I be on TV? That will be a great thing. The interesting thing is that as it's turned out, we succeeded on the internet and we failed on television, at least so far failed on television. I think we may yet have a life on television, but I think we have to rethink how that's going to be done. But I don't think anybody really expected the unbelievable difference in how you even put it, demographic awareness around the country between what goes on the internet and what goes on television. That, you know, we had this community that we had built up. We were doing, you know, many, many hits a day, you know, hundreds of thousands of page views a day. We were doing an average of, say, 110,000, 120,000 views on MySpace for every episode, which on MySpace is a big hit. It's the third biggest hit ever. In fact, those averages are higher than their biggest hits, Prom Queen and Roommates. We beat even Bikinis, you know, at least on average. So on the internet, we were doing really well. When we were promoted on YouTube for 48 hours, we got 700,000 hits in 36 hours. So, you know, nevertheless, even with all the stuff written about in the press, we had not penetrated the culture. People did not know about Quarter Life. And what I came to understand in a way I should have understood after all these years in the film and TV business is that the way you penetrate the culture is with mega expensive advertising campaigns. You know, when a show comes on TV or a movie is released, that's a $10, $15, $20, $30 million ad campaign, you know, and that's a campaign that then is orchestrated across all media, you know, TV, radio, magazines, long form, you know, TV spots. It's just an amazing machine that promotes media in our country. And if you don't have that, what we are coming to understand now is that America is an unbelievably fragmented culture and that we're really 6 or 7 different Americas. And most people just didn't know we existed. So NBC promoted us to a certain extent. But I think, you know, if you look at the numbers and what happened, I think the main thing was people just didn't know who we were or what we were. And I think for us to come back to television now, it's going to take time and it's going to take penetration into the culture across a lot of different platforms on the internet, There are a lot of different things we're going to have to do to make this work. So that kind of brings us up to where we are now. The interesting thing is, again, the difference just in the sort of power of television versus the internet. One poor showing on NBC caused traffic on our site to go up 250%. And it stayed up. It has actually stayed up. It came down to about 200%. And then another showing on Bravo just on Sunday made us go up again. And again, we've stayed up. So it's possible that just even from these two showings on TV, and I don't know if there'll be more or not, that we've gotten the jumpstart we needed to sort of keep this social network going. I'm going to spend a couple minutes talking about the social network, and then I think I should really take questions if you have them, because I could just pontificate forever. But I think, you know, you guys have come here and there might be things you want to know about what we're doing. You know, we've made a lot of mistakes, although we've also done certain things right. I think there's just a timeline online that I didn't understand before of how long it takes for things to penetrate. For instance, we've gotten calls in the last 2 days from 5 different universities where all of a sudden there's like this critical mass of kids at colleges who are aware of our show and going, what is this? And they want to go on the website and like they've discovered it after 4 months. I don't know where they were before or why it's happened now, or maybe the NBC thing had something to do with it. But, you know, what I've learned is this word viral is actually an even better word than people think, because in the real world of sicknesses, there different viruses have different ways of spreading, and our bodies have different defenses against different viruses. So not every virus is as viral as other viruses. And the same holds true on the internet, that, you know, if you're Will Ferrell talking to a 18-month-old, that's a virus that's going to go really fast all over and knock everybody down. You know, if you've got 8-minute segments where people are talking about their lives and what they should do with their lives, that's going to be a different viral process. But it has been viral and it is spreading. It's just spreading more slowly than I would have hoped, and more slowly than it needed to work on television. So at any rate, we've got this social network. I don't know how many of you here have seen the site or not, or whether I should go through it at all, but I'm just going to take a couple minutes just to show you sort of what it's about and what we're trying to do and why it's different from some others. I can't say that we're utterly unique, but I think that, you know, to the extent that we define ourselves as being about creativity and being about fostering the creative process in people and about creating connections between people around creativity, that certainly separates us from Facebook and to a great extent separates us from MySpace. There are sites, as you know, like iMeme and DeviantArt that are, I think iMeme is the closest to what we do. But again, I think the difference, and again, I don't presume to be an expert on iMeme, but I've, you know, spent time on it. I think the difference is that, again, there's a call out on our site and it's built into it. It's everywhere. It's in the fabric of it. There is a statement to the users that what we're interested in is authenticity, the authentic self, the authentic vision, the sort of getting to what is authentic about what you're doing, and then how can you sort of take that thing and put it out into the world and find your way with it. So, you know, we have this landing page here. And by the way, I'll just explain one thing. When we next do the show, and we are raising the money to do the to do more episodes of the show, what we're going to be doing is using the work of our own community to fill up the show. So we call it user-generated television, which is actually, you know, a little bit of an overstatement, but not entirely an overstatement, because what it means is that we have a lot of clothing designers on our site. We're going to use their designs for the actors. The art you see on the walls is going to be from our site. We're going to hire actors from the site, writers from the site, directors from the site. You know, there are an incredible number of talented people on the site, and we're going to use their efforts in the show and pay them and credit them. So in a sense, it will be the product of the community. The other thing we're doing, and there's another one down here, this here, is that we have always intended QuarterLife, the site, if we're lucky, to become a platform for other visions besides our own. We never thought it would just be about one series. We thought the whole idea is you have a community that self-selects for quality, that self-selects for talent, that you're going to get, you know, smart stuff on there. You're going to get people who are aspirational, people who are ambitious, who are making cool stuff, and that we can become a platform for these people so they don't have to be on the sites owned by the big companies. Now, we're too small really to be a platform right now, but what we're doing is meeting with a lot of content creators right now, talking about how we can provide them with the kind of syndication and the kind of expertise and the funding that they need to get their vision out there. I mean, in Los Angeles right now, the investment in short form online content is exploding, and there are a lot of companies getting into it. The thing is, in my mind, it's not all interchangeable. There's good and there's bad, and I'm only interested in the good. And, you know, the question is, how do you create the good? How do you find the good? How do you help the good find an audience? This is stuff we're all thinking about right now. But let me just show you sort of what's at the heart of our site, which is everybody's profile page, which we call My Studio. And the profile page is meant to be a, you know, what's interesting here is that it's not showing the whole page. Now, why would that be? I'm signed in. This is my page. Where's my portfolio? That's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. Let's go to somebody else's. That's really weird. It's not showing Flash stuff. Oh, Flash is not working on this computer. I love it. Okay. Well, believe me, it's so great. we have this thing called a portfolio, which is a Flash widget that you can export to your Facebook page or your MySpace. How can we get Flash working on this? Okay, cool. You know, one of the earliest ideas I had for the site was the notion that if you're an artist, you have a portfolio, you have something that shows what you've done. And when I went on these other sites, I didn't see anything that I felt paid due respect to the artist in terms of displaying their stuff. So we created this thing, which some people think looks a little bit like CoverFlow on iTunes, but is meant to be the thing that presents your top 25 pieces of media that you've uploaded that you want the world to see. It can be photos, video, writing, audio, whatever it is. And in a month, we're going to have multiple portfolios for people so that you can have a portfolio for your professional art and you can have a portfolio for, you know, pictures from the beach, that sort of thing. But it takes up a huge amount of space on your page. And it's a great way to show sort of what you're proud of. There we go. Thank you so much. Okay. All right. So this is my portfolio. And I use my portfolio because people know I started the site. People come. So I have a blog here that explains what the new build is and all that. But the point is, you know, you can have blogs or pictures or video, that sort of thing. For instance, here, this is the pilot of the, I'm sorry, this is the script for the pilot, which you can download so that anybody can, there's a PDF. You can download the pilot to the script and you can film your own version of the pilot if you want. The script for the pilot, sorry, not the pilot for the script. And I used to have a trailer on here, but I took it down. People's blogs, I'll go on other people as well. Here, let's just search. But the point is, what people used to do was just browse through these and just see, because people were doing such interesting stuff on their, you know, here, let me go to this person. I don't know who this person is, but we'll just check him out, her out. Just see what they, this computer is jumping. Don't jump. Here we go. Okay. So let's see what that is. This is photography from Europe, okay, for this person. All right, so for several months, that's, you know, then that's full size there. For several months, that's all we had to offer. But we finally finished a build that allows everyone to see what everybody is doing and allows us to call out the great stuff on the site. So if you see here, you have these channels, like let's look at photography, for instance. You go on the photography channel, and what you see is we have this UGQ, which means user-generated quarter life, which is basically everything that's been uploaded to the site. These are the stuff that we think is great. Here are the top users. You can look at what they're doing. You have recently the latest uploaded photography. And then we have this page that basically is everything that's been uploaded to the site, which is actually 242 pages of material, which you can filter any way you want. You want to look at photographs, you want to look at art, you want to look at stuff about psychology, you want to look at writing, and you can also filter it by rating, by views, and all that. So that basically this has allowed, and this has caused a huge jump in the community, because finally people can see what's going on and what other people are doing, essentially. And there's been a tremendous amount of interaction between people. We've actually had people from different parts of the country start to do projects together who had never even met just based on liking what they've done on this. So it's enabled people to connect at a level that I think a lot of them were hungering for, because many of these people were sort of doing this on their own without any guidance or help from anyone else. The other thing that's been interesting to me is the forum section of the site, which is really in many ways sort of has been the lifeblood of the site, is that there are so many amazing conversations here. Here's a great one that's been going on now for 3 months. I'm a virgin. And on it, there are, you know, you've got 100 posts on there. There are probably 30 people in their 20s and 30s who are talking about the fact that they're still virgins and why they are or why they've chosen to be. It's an amazing, you know, we had one about what it means to be an artist and a Christian in modern society, global climate change, Catholicism discussion. You know, here's Spitzer. You know, that we have all of these remarkable conversations going on, and they are also remarkably positive and respectful. There's just no snarkiness in them. It's amazing. People disagree. They argue all the time, but they argue in ways that are just incredibly respectful. There is a quality to the community that is supportive. And it's like it's made up of a bunch of people around the country who are artists themselves, who probably have felt alienated in some sense in their lives, have felt like observers, have felt, you know, like they were watching what other people did. And, you know, that's what I was in high school. And there's a way in which there's an energy on the site that allows people to reveal themselves and to connect with other people in a way that doesn't make them feel diminished. So that's what we're building. And that's, you know, it's expanding at a really fast rate. We've only been alive for 4 months you know, the number of users and the number of page views and the number of visits each day is expanding at an amazing rate. So we're very, really proud of this and happy with this and really proud of the show and really sort of bummed out by the fact that television didn't work so well, at least so far. So, you know, there are a lot of different things we tried to do in a different way on this. Some have worked, some have not. And, you know, I can keep talking, but why don't I see if you guys sort of want to ask me anything and we can take the conversation from there. Go to the mic so that we can hear you.
Hello. I get the sense that for a long time there's been this sense of hierarchy that in terms of media, it goes movies, TV, internet, that if you can't make it in movies, well, you can try TV. Well, TV doesn't work out well, you can get your stuff on the internet. But I wonder if that's a generational thing and if that's starting to change, where you'll have something released on the internet and the goal is never necessarily to get to TV. It's just to be what it is. So I'm wondering if you think that is a coming trend.
I think that is such a smart thing you just said. And it's so interesting how it's changed. You know, when I was in film school, and I'm scared to tell you what year that was, but it was really a long time ago. I got my first job and it was in television. And Ed Zwick and I sat and we said, we're going to make sure that we're not brainwashed into thinking that television is good. We know television is bad and we only want to make movies. And we've seen these people make television and start to think television is good because they're doing it. And of course, what happened was we started making television, and that was a moment in the late 70s when all of a sudden movies sort of dumbed down and television got really interesting with Hill Street Blues and a lot of other interesting shows. And lo and behold, you know, for a long time, we were the only producers who went back and forth between television and movies. It was a completely segregated world. You were either in television or you were in movies. The next person to do it was Barry Levinson with what was it called?
Homicide.
What's that?
Homicide.
Yeah. And yes, there was this absolute stigma about television that it was lesser than movies. What happened finally was that, you know, in Los Angeles, at some level, money talks. And there were people on television getting so rich that they finally got respect in some way. And I think the movie business has just become such a difficult business to be in that a lot of people now do both. A lot of people do commercials as well because it's just so frustrating to be in the movie business. Now what's happening on the internet is you have a lot of people like me who are one step behind me, who are going, now, what is this internet thing? This is interesting. I mean, I can do what I want and I can just put it up there. Of course, they're making the same mistake now that I made a year ago, believing that you can just make your thing and put it on YouTube and then, you know, millions of people will watch it. When we put Quarter Life on YouTube for the first 3 weeks, you couldn't even find it. Even if you searched for it, you couldn't find it. We had a channel on it and you still couldn't search for it. It wasn't until they promoted it. So it's easy to be invisible on the internet. But the point is there are a lot of people in Hollywood now thinking about the internet, but they're really scared of the fact that there's no money in it. There's no money to be made from it, and there's no money for your project on it. So that's a difficult problem. The interesting thing that I'm seeing is because I speak a lot at film schools, is I talk to these kids at film school and I say to them, you guys got to go on the internet. Forget television. You know, television is horrible. And they look at me like I'm crazy because all they want to do is do television, you know, because that's in their generation, that was the king, you know. And they think, oh, well, the professionals do television. Yeah, the professionals do television and have the networks tell them everything they should do. And you know, and they have no piece of the back end. And you know, they're essentially exploited by a system. And I'm not blaming any one corporation. It's just that's the way television works. So, yes, I think it's changing very quickly. But I think the thing that's holding it back is money. I think that we have not yet figured out how to get advertisers to spend the kind of money on the internet that they spend on television. And I think we're a couple of years away from that. I think inevitably they're going to, as television, you know, continues its decline. I think there's so much of an investment in this country in the advertising industry, both from the corporations that do the advertising and the advertising agencies themselves, that it's in their interest to keep spending money. So if their money stops being worth much on television, then they'll spend it on the internet because they'll say that's the only game in town. So yeah, it's changing for sure. Just watch it in the next year.
Thanks.
Cool. Next one, yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Ooh, loud. My name is Camille. I'm from Portland, Oregon. And
hi.
I'm a publicist by day and a writer at heart. And this talk has been really interesting from a promotional and business standpoint, but my questions come from my heart. So I'm wondering about the writing process. You said that you were going to be taking user-generated content, but I'm wondering what kind of writing staff you have, you know, paid staff, full-time staff. Does it work the way it does in LA where they're all in a room creating every day? Or, you know, just talk about that for me. That'd be great.
Sure. We did 6 hours of this show, and I wrote two, and I had two other writers, both in their 20s. One was named Lucy Teitler, who came from Yale, and I read a screenplay that she wrote that I thought was brilliant, so I hired her. And the other writer was Devin Gummersall, who played Brian Krakow in My So-Called Life, who has been in two of our series and has remained a close friend. And I've known him since he's 14, and now he's all grown up. He's 28, I think. And he's a wonderful director and writer, and he wrote two episodes. So I have an absolute horror of writer rooms. I cannot possibly imagine being creative in front of more than two people. In fact, even two people is hard for me. So I've never had a writer's room on any of my shows. Basically, Ed and I will sit and work out the story with the writer of that episode, and then the writer will go off and write that episode. In this case, I did a certain amount of rewriting on these just because both of these writers were fairly new to the business, and you know, I just needed to sort of do the finishing polish. But they did amazing work, and I will bring them back. And I very, very much hope to hire writers through my site. Absolutely. And we have amazing writing being put up on the site. There's so much writing being put up on the site right now. It's kind of incredible. Blogging, somebody's put a novel up, people are putting screenplays up. You know, that part has been amazing. People are really responding. So, cool.
Regarding the length of the content, can you discuss what the arguments of the experts were about why it had to be short, and what you've learned since then, and whether or not it's related to quality of the content?
Well, their argument was based on metrics that they felt, you know, I mean, there was research to show that people would watch for 2 minutes, and then after 2 minutes, there was just a huge fall off. You know, it was sort of this. Canard that, you know, everybody on the internet has ADD and can only have 2 minutes of attention on anything. And I think, look, there's a certain truth. I'm the same. You know, we surf the internet. We, you know, you do sort of prowl around. But I also feel that more and more people are getting used to the idea of watching longer form things on their computers. It's just a cultural shift. It's a habit shift, you know, and by the way, it's not nearly complete yet. I mean, I think, you know, what I keep saying is that I think there's going to be a show. I don't think it's this one. You know, we had our chance and I don't think it happened, but I think there's going to be a show where millions of people go, oh my God, I have to see this thing. And it comes out twice a week, three times a week, whatever it is. And millions of people are waiting at their computer at 7 o'clock at night for the new episode of that thing. And that's going to change the habits overnight. I look at it, to me, I think I call it the iPod moment. You know, when the iPod came out, millions of people took one look at it and said, oh yeah, of course, that's how I'm going to do my music. Fine. And it was like an instantaneous decision by millions of people that changed forever how we do music. But it didn't exist before that. The same thing's going to happen with online content. We don't know where it's going to come from or when it's going to come. But I think once one program has that breakthrough and people get used to the idea of, oh, I can't wait to watch that thing on my computer, then there's going to be a whole bunch of other stuff. We're just not there yet. I can tell you that on MySpace and on my site, there's been an avalanche of complaints about how short our episodes are. And when the episodes are under 8 minutes, you know, people get so mad at us. You didn't show anything in this episode. Nothing changed. You know, they get really mad. So now, is that some small minority? I don't know. But it seems to me, by the way, we went to MySpace halfway through the run and we said, look, we'd like to try one of two other modalities here. We'd like to either do it three times a week instead of twice a week at 8 minutes, or we'd like to try it 16 minutes twice a week and see what happens. And MySpace said, look, we have sold all the advertising time. We've already scheduled all these. We can't change the release pattern now. So sorry. But I still believe, and I said from the beginning, I said it actually in a number of interviews, I said, this is totally arbitrary. This notion of 8 minute things, there's no sense to it. And I'm happy to change it if something else works better. And, you know, knock on for Micah, we get another season, I'm going to, you know, I already think I'm going to try a different release pattern than what we did. I think it was too frustrating to people twice a week, 8 minutes. It was just not quite enough to sort of be satisfying. So this is one of those things where it's changing just underneath us as we talk right now. And the other thing we have to be thinking about, you know, we talk about this, but people are not conceptualizing it enough. 4 years from now, there's going to be a continuum. And at one end of the continuum are going to be people who still have rabbit ears on their television. And if they have a computer, they have dial-up. That's one end of the continuum. Or the other end of the continuum is going to be somebody with probably at that point an 80-inch screen in their room that where they watch their television and do their computing on the same instrument. And by the way, there are probably a million people in America who do that right now or more, but that will become widespread. And when they walk out of the room, it will automatically transfer to the thing in their kitchen or to their, you know, handheld device or something like that. And this notion of convergence scares the shit out of these companies, but nobody is trying to figure out what that's going to look like. Is that going to be an internet template, or is it going to be a TV template, or somewhere in between? It's like people are not doing the work to figure out what that's going to look like when they converge. And I actually thought that we were trying to take a step in that direction, saying, oh, you could have a multi-platform piece of entertainment. It can be on the internet. It can be on television. You can see it when you want to see it. You can see it in different lengths. You can see the extra material on the internet. I still think that can work. It may not have worked for ours for any number of reasons, and I'll take the blame for some of them. But I still think as a concept, that's where we have to go. So,
okay. Thanks.
We're cool. Okay, next.
Hey, Marshall. Kevin Myers from Humdinger TV. Hi. I did a web series last year called Intramural Glory.
Called, say it again?
Intramural Glory, about aging athletes hanging on to their athletic careers. It was viewed by hundreds of thousands of people, which was great and swell because, you know, it's nice to be, have your work seen. I haven't made any money off of it, though, and I'm looking at doing a second season and kind of looking at monetization possibilities. And I don't know if pre-roll and post-roll and web overlay ads are really what's going to get it done. I wonder if you had any thoughts on different ways to monetize and if product integration into storylines and that sort of thing might be a possibility.
Well, we did a couple of product integrations on our show. Actually, we only did one product integration on our show, and people think it's Toyota, but it wasn't. If you've seen our show, if you saw the pilot, you know that Toyota's all over the damn thing. The guys make a commercial for a Toyota dealership. But that was not at that time a product integration. I had written in the script that they're doing a commercial for a local car dealer. So when my production people said, what kind of car? I said, oh, well, let's use Toyota because they make hybrids. So we called Toyota and we said, can we use a Prius? And they said, yeah, you can have a Prius. So they gave us a Prius, which immediately broke down, which I totally loved. And so the car in our pilot is our production designer's Prius because the Prius they gave us was in the shop. But I said, okay, can you give us a car dealer? Can you give us a Toyota dealer? And they said, oh, no, we don't control the dealers. You'll have to do that yourself. So I had to go to the Toyota dealer in Culver City and pay him just like anybody else to shoot there. So, you know, it looks like a product integration, but it ain't. We did later get Toyota to agree to advertise on the show, but that was 9 months later. And actually, believe it or not, when you deal with corporations and promotion and advertising, they are incredibly specific. And they weren't interested in the fact that we were showing a Prius. That meant nothing to them. They wanted us to show the new Corolla that was coming out, you know. And then finally, it was the Yaris that decided to do it. And those are all different departments. They don't even speak to each other. But the point is, we did do a product integration with Pepsi that was actually quite complicated because it was about a website that Pepsi is supporting called Deep Rock Drive, where they do online interactive concerts, live concerts. And it worked out well for us. It was a good storyline, and Pepsi paid us a whole bunch of money for it. So, you know, if you can do a product integration that you feel doesn't do injury to the integrity of what you're doing, then that's great. It's really hard to do, by the way. I mean, you know, we turn down a lot of things And I'm generally extremely wary of product integrations because, you know, I grew up, you know, I was a kid. I was a young kid in the 1950s. And I remember, you know, when advertisers ruled the airwaves and everything was determined by the advertisers. And the star of a show would stop the show and then turn and advertise the cigarettes to you and then go back into the show. And the newsmen would stop the news to do a commercial for, you know, some product. And that was all, you know, there was a revolution that took place in the late 60s when the advertisers were pushed out of the decision-making process in television. And now they're back in. So I'm wary about it. But nevertheless, how the hell else are we going to make money? You know, so in our case, we were extremely careful. I felt that we did it in a way that was respectful and it helped us get started. So I would say, yes, if you can do product integrations, do them. They're tough to negotiate. You tend to need somebody of some form of agent on your side to make it happen. You know, it's hard to sort of walk through the doors of Procter and Gamble and get somebody to talk to you.
Did you experience any blowback from your fans when that storyline ran, or were they pretty accepting?
Well, it's interesting. I got blowback on things that were not product integrations. In other words, people were pissed off at the Toyota product integration, but it wasn't one. People were pissed off at the Apple product integration, but it wasn't one. So hardly anybody said anything about Pepsi. I think we had one comment about Pepsi because there was in the concert, you could see the Pepsi logo behind them. But it was minor. And also, I think, you know, I think people understand this generation in particular, that people now in their 20s who have been sold to their whole lives, I think it's your world to be sold to. And you sort of know, sort of, it's kind of like when you're on the street in New York and people come up to you and you've grown up in New York, you know when somebody's out to kill you, you know when somebody's out for a buck, and you know when somebody's just funny. Do you know what I mean? You kind of know it's being street smart in a way. So I think most people got it. And most people got that we were just trying to do our thing and that the soul of the show had not been taken over by the advertisers. So I would say it worked out well for us.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Hi, Marshall. How are you?
I'm good.
Great. My name is Jerry, and I actually produce a weekly show where I interview, it's a documentary where I interview young women, middle-aged women about sex. And
That's a good gig.
Yeah, it is. I really like it a lot. It's the Jerry T Show, and you spell it Jerry with a G. So one of the things that I heard you saying that kind of resonates with me is the fact that you're really successful online, but it kind of bothers you that you weren't that successful on NBC. And for me, I'm struggling with that as well as a documentary filmmaker where I have a very captivated subject matter and a very captivated audience on a weekly basis as to should I be happy and content being on the web or should I say, okay, the web is my lost leader. I use the web to create a name for myself, for my vision, my portfolio, like you mentioned earlier, and really transition that into other things because the budget's there and pretty much most individuals have TVs, and I think that's why the advertisers don't want to get away from, you know, financing the web, because the web is something that, you know, your grandmother, great-grandmother, your aunt might not have a computer or might not be comfortable going to a computer to watch content. So my question to you is, what were the lessons that you learned at NBC that right now you're able to translate and trickle down into the quarter life online? That's the first question. The second question is, should I be happy getting, you know, the 3,000 views I get on a weekly basis for one episode, or should I just kind of be saying to myself, hey, it's not really translating into something big?
No, I get it. These are really good questions. I mean, I wrestle with this every day. And
Help me, please.
I think, you know, I of all people should have understood that there is a difference between the audience for online and the audience for television. I didn't really understand that because it's too hard to define the online audience. The online audience is so remarkably unpredictable and fragmented. And, you know, it's like when I hear the numbers for things that I think are so obscure and I hear, you know, oh, they've got 2 million people on their site, you know, talking about, you know, talking about restoring 1927, you know, chords. And, you know, it's like there are things that work on the internet that would never work on television. And there is an element of television that you cannot get around, which is that it's mass entertainment. It is. And it has to work at a mass level. And it's funny, I got in trouble for saying this, and I'm going to say it again, and I didn't mean it in the way it came out. I was at Harvard Business School the day after we were on NBC, and I was quoted as saying we should never have been on NBC, which is not what I said, because I don't believe that. I'm actually incredibly grateful that they gave us a shot. What I said was that I was afraid, even before we went on, I was afraid that for the very reasons why I decided this would be a show that I wanted to do on the internet, where I didn't try to make it into a mass entertainment, I was afraid that we would not find the audience on NBC that we would need. Now, I hoped, and I talked myself into believing, and you know, but nevertheless, I didn't construct it as a mass entertainment. I've learned over the years how you make something into a mass entertainment. I can't say I always succeed, but I know, you know. And it wasn't until literally the night it was on NBC. I was sitting in a hotel room in New York. I was sitting with Bitsy Tulloch, who plays Dylan in the show, and my daughter, and Barrett Swatek, who plays Brittany, who in the show is Dylan's nemesis at work. I don't know if you've seen the show, but in the show, they utterly hate each other. And in real life, they're best friends. And Barrett's mother. We're all sitting there watching this show in New York. Now, you have to understand, every single bit of my work on this show up until this time has been on TV screens. All the editing has been on a monitor. You know, all watching the DVDs. I'm watching basically TV screens for the last year of putting this show together. But because I've been doing this for a long, long time, when I'm in a hotel room in New York and I turn on the TV and I'm seeing my show and it's being broadcast on television, I all of a sudden looked at it and went, oh my God. And in the first minute, I just knew that we weren't going to get the audience. I knew because I know after all these years what it takes for something to be a television show. And this wasn't a television show. You know, it might be a cable show because that's 2 million people as opposed to the 8 million people you need on TV. I mean, I shouldn't even say anymore that's not a television show because television has changed so much. It's even that has become fragmented. What I meant by that was it's not a big network television show like I've spent the last 25 years making. That's what it's not. And I knew in one minute, I knew it was not that on TV. And in fact, I sat there and I predicted the number and I was right. I predicted the audience number just based on looking at it. So I have to tell you that probably what you have is better on the internet. And the thing to do is to figure out how you can get an even bigger audience on the internet, how you can get this thing to take off, how you can find other, I don't know what your platform is. I don't know if you have your own site or if you're on other sites.
I have my own site.
Well, the thing is to get it on other sites, to get it all over the place. You know, I've learned so many lessons. I've learned that if something is on MySpace, you know, a lot of people know about it, but a lot of people never go on MySpace. They don't know it exists. You know, you've got to be on all these different sites. You know, they call it hypersyndication, syndication, all these different words now for how you can promulgate your thing and get it all over the place. That's another way for it to spread because in each case, somebody somewhere might see it who hadn't seen it, who tells a friend, you know, and right now they don't know it exists. So I would say concentrate on that rather than trying to get to television.
Okay. Thank you, Marshall. I appreciate your time and your advice.
Sure. What do we got? Okay, a few more minutes. Go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering about the future of Quarter Life. And if you can't do another season on TV, will you still do another season online? And if you don't do another season, will the social networking aspect still stay?
I wish I had answers for those things. We're trying to work that out right now. I would say I'll answer the last one first. The social network is definitely going to stay around. It's building, like I said, very fast. And we're also working very quickly now to create other content for it. That's something we were always going to do, but we've had to move up the timetable, obviously, because we thought we were going to have this 6-week run on NBC and blah, 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 blah. So there will be other content on the website. And there are going to be a lot of other functionalities on the website. For instance, in a few weeks, we're starting an internship program where we're going to be placing interns in all these different fields, architects, offices, and photographers, and magazines, and publishers, and that sort of thing. And we have a bunch of contests we're going to be doing, meaning that if someone wins on the basis of the piece of work they put up there, they're going to get a job with a certain company or have an opportunity, that sort of thing. So yeah, we're totally committed to the website, and I think the website is going to survive. If we cannot figure out a television play for the show, then we're going to have to figure out how to make the show more cheaply, which will inevitably change the show. And that's what we're trying to figure out right now. And as soon as I have that answer, I'll let you know. Right. The great thing is the actors are all very committed. It's a very close-knit bunch of people. Everybody wants to keep doing this thing. It's possible, I haven't even said this before, but it's possible that in the meantime, we may do our own version of an online reality show about getting the show made. In other words, we have these actors, we have this process, we have all these people that want to see these actors anyway. There's an inherently dramatic thing going on, which is, are we going to make this work or not? What's happening with their lives? And so we're talking about, creating something that is around the show, but isn't the show, but keeps the feeling of the show alive. So we're exploring a lot of different possibilities, but thank you for asking.
Thank you.
All right. So this is probably the last question.
Good. Yeah. As long as we're doing thank yous. First, I never thought I would get to thank you in person for 30 something, which had a huge influence on my life. Everyone knows it's my favorite show.
Were you born yet?
I was a very young watcher. I don't know why, but it left an imprint for storytelling on my brain. So thank you. And congratulations on this. It's beautiful. It's compelling. It's so exciting. I make alternate reality games, which is a similar genre of serial storytelling online. And I was really interested in what you said at the beginning about not liking, authority and people telling you what to do with your creative. And I'm sure you've had a similar experience that ARG designers have, which is that the audience is very much like producers in a way sometimes. They're very vocal about characters they like and don't like and where the story should go and not. So just wondering if you pay attention to people talking about it, if it gives you grief, if it gives you joy, how much you feel like you should let the project be influenced by the community's very vocal thoughts. That is,
go ahead.
That's it.
Oh, that is such a good question. Making television shows, even in the world of the internet and email, is nothing like an online show. I mean, I just never really paid attention to what the audience was saying before. Even when we had fan sites, I would go on maybe once a week and just read. I'm on my site literally 10 times a day, and I've had to deal with the fact that, yes, everybody has opinions. Now, I've learned over the years, every time we do a preview of a movie and we go and we listen to a focus group, you realize that there is no such thing as consensus. Everybody is an eccentric, and everybody has their own ideas, and you finally – You can't be ruled by any one thing a person says. There are a couple of answers to what you're saying. One is, and this has, by the way, been true when I've gotten notes from networks and studios in the past, I look at myself as a doctor. And my, I've made this piece of work. And if the audience or the network or the studio has a problem with it, I listen to what they tell me. And to me, that's the symptoms. They're describing the symptoms of the disease. That's not necessarily what the disease is. It's up to me to figure out and diagnose what the disease is and cure it. They're just telling me what's bothering them. So if I look at it that way, it's much easier for me to understand. This fits into another concept I use in all of my work, which is something I call a creative vacuum, which is to say this, that if I've done my work right as a filmmaker, when I make a movie or a TV show, if I've written it correctly and I've directed it correctly and I've casted it and all of that, the audience will be swept along and never have a moment of self-awareness or self-consciousness or criticism about what's going on. They'll just be completely taken up by what I've done. Now, that's the optimum. You never reach that, okay? And when you don't reach that, it means there's this small creative vacuum that crept in there that they rushed to fill with their own feelings and thoughts and reactions. It means I didn't control what they were feeling at that moment. And I don't mean to put it in such a harsh way. It's not like I'm trying to control that. But as a storyteller, it is my job to sort of guide the audience's experience. And if they're not having the experience I want them to have, it's my fault. I did something wrong, or I dropped the ball, whatever it is. I have to figure out how can I fix that. But what you realize online is that there's just a level of background noise of people's dissatisfaction with everything you do, no matter what. And you have to sort of go along with that. And by the way I've dealt with it on my site is that I am there on the forums talking with them, and I don't get defensive, and I say, okay, well, I get that. This is what I had in mind. Maybe I could have done it better, or I don't see it that way, you know, but I'm sort of there and available to them in some way. But the point is, I still have to use my judgment to say, okay, here's this person who says, get rid of Vanessa, she's mean, you know, Deborah should figure out this. Oh, Lisa, don't go with that guy, blah, 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 which I just basically ignore because that's just people shouting out their, you know, but there are criticisms that come up that I either agree with or I hadn't thought of before, or, you know, I have to deal with in some way. And then that's my responsibility. I can't really be swayed by, it's this complex relationship with your audience where you are taking in what they say, but you have to keep your own integrity as a filmmaker. I've always said this show is not interactive. It may be participatory, but it's not interactive. There's a difference. And that participatory part of it has turned out to be very important to me and really great. But that doesn't mean they tell me, you know, how the episode should end or whether I should get rid of that character or not. So that's kind of where we come out on that. We'll see. I guess we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming, for listening.